Well, Carlos, let me hear that question. Word limit, the two questions. If we are to take out all the binary from the three artists, only with Longfellow, it's quite a few. Walt Whitman is a lot of poems, don't you think? The question is quite ambitious. I had the same feeling that it was very long to, it was very difficult to fit into the word limits. I mean, if I have to choose, I would rather you stayed within the limits. But as the exam does no longer penalize students for exceeding the word limit that was removed a couple of years ago, I mean, we have to do the same thing that the Equipo Docente does. So feel free to go above the word limit. Wow, 248 words only with Longfellow. That's a lot of stuff. How much is it? If I don't remember, yeah, I mean, if only I could. I have problems compressing them in an hour and a half. Imagine trying to compress them into 500 words. Yeah, I understand. I understand what you mean. The thing is that the PECs are slightly more complicated now because they resemble the structure of examinations. And the tendency that the Professor Gibert has had is to choose three authors instead of two to compare in the PECs. So you have the same situation that you have in an exam environment. Because the word limit hasn't changed, it probably should. I the word limit is more than anything a reference for students. I assure you that the most of the essays that I read are within the 400 word threshold. So people don't need 500 words, or they don't have enough original ideas to express more than 400 or words or so about the authors. In any case, if you pass the threshold, don't worry at all, because I won't take it into consideration, and I haven't taken it into consideration, especially in a question like this where there are many things to comment. I don't remember exactly, was it? Is it referring to, let me see if this changes. To binary opposition of life versus death. It's an interesting topic. There are many things to say. Yeah, I understand that you might go over 500 words. I'm surprised that your analysis of Longfellow extended almost 300 words, but that's good news. Remember that one of the typical shortcomings that I sometimes notice in many PECs and I can give you so many on Whitman only. Good. That's good news. That means that you're in command of the content. So that's a primary thing. Then there is Dickinson, full of life and death, binary opposition. Okay. But remember, in any case, that the key component here when you're writing your PEC, Cesar, I really hope that you write this PEC and you don't do like in the first semester. I'm sure you have great ideas and I want to read them. You should almost there. Great. So happy for your change of mind. The most important thing is for you to, from the very beginning, even though in a first draft you may just compile information on Longfellow, may compile information on Whitman, and may compile information on Dickinson, the exercise requires you to weave all that information from the beginning. So it's not going to normally work to be to describe Longfellow, describe Whitman, and describe Dickinson. We're expecting you to come up with the relevant comparisons and contrast from the three authors from the beginning. So more than focusing different paragraphs on each and then going on to the comparison and contrast, I wouldn't do it that way. Because normally what happens is that you use a lot of energy to describe each of the authors, and you lose momentum when you have to compare and contrast them in a meaningful way. I would engage in the comparison and contrast from the beginning. How does that binary opposition work in the works of each of them? Would have been more than enough. discuss them. Are you sure? I think I saw compare and contrast. Discuss the binary opposition. Okay, well, if it says discuss, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Both questions are discuss. Well, I stand corrected. It's a change in terms of what they normally ask. Well, then I stand amended. If you decide to describe them in blocks, you have to maintain a certain balance and a certain cohesive element between the authors. It would be quite awkward if you devoted 300 words to one author and 100 to another one and 400 to a third one. So whatever you decide in terms of length and in terms of depth, it should be more or less balanced in all the authors. Compare and contrast. I would say that that's the more natural way of approaching authors related to a same topic. So César, it's fine. I'll since most of the time in the exams you're asked to compare and contrast, I would say it's a very good exercise working towards the exam. 100 words to describe life and death binary on Dickinson, the Queen of Death. No, I'm not saying that 100 words for that. I would say that whatever amount of profoundness you decide to apply to your work, look for a balance because I mean we notice this sometimes when the peck is about an author that we've recently covered in class, that we get a lot of information about authors from the beginning of the term and just a few details from the most recent author that we cover. That normally implies that the student has not had the opportunity to study that author as much as he had the opportunity to study the rest. I guess it's not so much about each poem, but a general view of a exactly, Elena. You can use the poems that you have as your universe of reference. And if you want to bring any other poems of the author, that's fine as well. I think it would be a bit challenging for you to do that at this point. But you can do that. We've seen his students say, I'm familiar with these poems from Walt Whitman and they make a lot of sense in this analysis, and I'm going to use them for this purpose. Fine. Or Dickinson or whatever. And not only referring to poetry, but also prose. If there's another work from the author that you think is extremely relevant, even though it's not course material, if it's a meaningful comparison, or if you want to, a student was bringing one of your classmates sent me an email. I haven't had the opportunity to reply yet of an essay that reminded her to Dickinson. Yeah, that's great. If you use a literary source with the meaningful purpose, you can feel free to use whatever material helps you get to the point that you want to get. That said, you have to bear in mind that that the PEC is more or less a training ground to get you ready for the examination. So you can overdo it. You can turn one of these specs into a 20-page essay if you wanted to, if you investigated profoundly enough. But I think it's not the purpose. The purpose is to train you sufficiently to get you ready for the examination. So, of course, I love to read works that are insightful and that go beyond the bare sufficient to get the work done and strives for perfection and strives for excellence. It's always great to read those essays, but I don't want to overburden you with the feeling that you have to extend beyond those 500 words. I think that to as this is an introductory course and you do have some sufficient tools to go beyond those 500 words, but if you try to stay in the realm of that limit, it's also fine. Okay, let me read from the chat. There are two comments here. I guess it's not so much about each poem, but a general view. Yes, it can be a general view. It can focus on the poems. Don't get stressed. I know where you stand. This peck is trying to chew more than I can swallow. Yeah, I know. It's a very demanding peck, but at the same time, it's fascinating. Okay. So it can, the thing is that it's fantastic to read that you're engaged in trying to find the information you need to, work through it. And that's great news. Without further ado, because we have a lot to read today, let's get going with Frederick Douglass. We have, oh my God, these are the classics. Jesus, Elena, Carlos, and César. Okay, great. We're going to deal with Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass is a major figure of the 19th century. It's impossible to analyze American culture and American literature without understanding the importance of the American Civil War and without having the most important figure in terms of abolitionism and slavery and to understand the cultural and social significance of Frederick Douglass in American society. Frederick Douglass's life spans through the 19th century, and his body of work lies on three versions, reviewed versions of his autobiography. So the work of the author is autobiographical, and it's going to allow us to revisit autobiographies that we've seen are a popular genre in this early American literature, and we've already gone through a few of these for sure. Olauda Equiano, for sure. Benjamin Franklin, even though we didn't delve too much into his autobiography, it was beyond the scope of this course. And you might recall Mary Rowlandson's captivity narrative, which has an autobiographical feel, even though it's limited to her period of captivity. In fact, we started the course with an autobiographical a reference that is that has the problem of reliability when we studied the work of Captain John Smith from the very beginning of this course we've studied autobiography as a very important way of expressing and conveying the reality of early American culture, early American lifestyle. And even though we say that those are the biographies or the autobiographies that we have come to to categorize as such. There's a bit of autobiography in practically every author that we've dealt with. I mean, who cannot say that Thoreau's work is not autobiographical, or Nathaniel Hawthorne and how he talks about religious communities that that are very similar to the one he lived in. Anne Bradstreet's poetry is autobiographical. There is autobiography hidden in between the lines of Phyllis Wheatley's work. Autobiography is one of the key vehicles to convey knowledge of this period. Frederick Douglass is different from Olaudah Equiano in terms of being a pivotal figure of the American Civil War. The American Civil War spanned over the course of 4 years, from 1861 to 1865. So it also divides experience or the reality of 19th century America in two blocks, before the American Civil War and after the American Civil War, where a triumphant North emerged and a defeated South was punished for their seditious acts and their acts of betrayal on the nation. Was the American Civil War a matter of slavery only? Of course not. It had to do with many other things. It was a power struggle. It was a way of rebalancing or coming to terms with parts of American reality that were no longer acceptable after the independence from the British Empire. The nation was less than 100 years old, but it was already put to the biggest of tests of having brothers and families torn apart, parts of the state due to a civil war that had very clear winners and very clear losers. The Civil War is triggered. We're going to study next week. Well, no, sorry. We're going to study after Easter. And next week we don't have class. I'll ask you afterwards where you're traveling to on your Easter vacation. Just a small joke there. Confinement joke. We have to have at least one of those every week. After Easter, we're going to cover Harriet Beecher Stowe. Harriet Beecher Stowe's work is so popular that it's become a paradigm of racialism in America. Uncle Tom's Cabin is a work that everybody seems to be familiar with. What it stands for, even though very few people have actually read it, I mean, outside of the United States. And so it has a cultural resonance. And this is the point where we're going to reach cultural references that have outlived the authors and that have reached our times. Last week, we were talking about Emily Dickinson as a literary figure that continues to influence current poets. In the case of Frederick Douglass and Harriet Beecher Stowe, who met in during their lifetime and were fond of each other, we're going to see the two major figures of abolitionism from the cultural perspective, from the political perspective. We know that President Abraham Lincoln was a key figure in American politics against slavery, and in a decisive act, he issued the Emancipation Act. The Emancipation Act released from the bonds of slavery all the slaves in America, and created a very significant problem that had not been sufficiently thought over, because the problem, the underlying problem that passing from slavery to freedom overnight provoked was that basically you had first of all, if this emancipation had been accepted and there hadn't been a civil war, you would have had a situation where overnight millions of freed Negro Americans would have been freed from from the bonds of slavery, but that had no way of earning a livelihood because they had no jobs. They had no social recognition. They lived in extremely racist communities, and they were that created a tremendous problem. What are the effects of those problems? If you've studied, I think you studied Mundos Anglófonos in your first course. I guess most of you have already taken the subject Mundos Anglófonos when you study American literature. I mean American history. I don't know if you get this deep into the matter, because when I studied it, the subject was slightly different. The American Civil War provoked a huge divide, a huge social divide between the North and the South, not only in terms of Reconstruction and how the South was suddenly impoverished after the American Civil War. The freed slaves had very little interest in remaining in the places where they were from, and the states of the South lost a great deal of population of migrant African Americans that moved towards areas in droves. And when I mean in droves, I mean in hundreds of thousands, and they went to cities like Detroit, St. Louis, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, and other places, creating a new lower impoverished class that was fighting for the worst kind of underpaid jobs with the rest of the lower class Americans. So that situation of going from a racist country that defended slavery to let's label this non-racist in theory a country that had no solution for millions of people that had moved to new cities in search of opportunity, and that were met with the same racism that they had already confronted during their entire life in the South of the United States, is the driving force that we have in this new reality. And I think that Frederick Douglass's biography is so important because it gives you a glimpse at this situation. I know that it's very difficult to excerpt passages of the book, but if you do have the opportunity of reading or even listening to during this confinement period, for example, it's a good opportunity of listening. The entire book is available on LibriVox, the free audio book of books in the public domain. The narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass is an excellent read or an excellent listen, and or you can do both at the same time, and it's going to allow you to understand the situation that many of these African Americans had. In the case of Frederick Douglass, first it's his fight from slavery to freedom. And afterwards, it's a situation where he's going to turn into a very relevant statesman and spokesperson for the cause of abolitionism. And we're going to see how his figure is considered one of the most important figures in American history, especially at this pivotal moment. Frederick Douglass is considered the most influential black person in the 19th century in America and probably in the world. So this gives you a solid understanding of why the importance of Frederick Douglass. It's important to include Frederick Douglass in an introductory course like this one. Besides that, he was extremely talented, extremely intelligent, and his narrative itself has sufficient literary quality to gain him a place in this selection of excellent authors that we have in the second semester. In this unit, we're going to study something that in literature is really important. In fact, let me show you something. I'm going to read a paragraph afterwards from my latest purchase. This is a book that I bought at the beginning of the year. I traveled to United States, and this is what I expect to read during the course of the quarantine. It's a Pulitzer Prize winning book called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, and it's the most recent, and it's considered one of the best biographies of the 21st century, written about an American figure. It's been hailed as a very important piece that gives a new dimension of understanding in terms of the life of Frederick Douglass, and also as a portrayal of the time that he lived. Of course, you don't have to read the biography. That's just me that I'm especially interested in this work in particular, and in this period, especially in American literature and in American history. But just goes to show how relevant Frederick Douglass is for American culture and American the reality of American culture even nowadays. Frederick Douglass has been commonly quoted in speeches by Obama over the course of the years, and there is so many more things that we can talk about. Frederick Douglass. In terms of what is important and what you should walk away with in this unit, I'm going to write a word here with my clumsy letter in this tablet I have in front of me. Epiphany. I don't know if you've already studied epiphanies. If you've in American literature, epiphany is studied in particular in contemporary American literature. There are several works that, from the ones that the Equipo Docente selected in that course in particular, that have to do with epiphany. Epiphany is a religious word that has to do with realization, with coming to a new understanding, to awakening to an idea. And I think that that Frederick Douglass's work has a lot of epiphany in it. There are certain points in the narrative where the author that is talking about his life and his life decisions explains that he understands in a particular moment something about his future. And for example, there is an epiphany or an epiphanic moment in the book early on, where he realizes that he has to leave behind him the path of slavery. In another moment, he understands what he has to do to achieve freedom. In another moment, at the end of the book, he understands what his purpose in life has to be from there on. That's a succession of epiphanies in his biography, I think, are very relevant and something worth noting in terms of what's interesting about what is especially relevant in literary terms regarding the narrative of the life of of Frederick Douglass. I don't know if Epiphany is included here in the glossary. No, it isn't. Remember that. Well, Epiphany. Yeah, it sounds very religious as a term, but it's actually it is a religious term. But in literary terms, Epiphany is used as a moment of awakening from to a new reality. It's a moment where you understand that you understand what you have to do, or the character in a story understands his path or his purpose. The pathos, what we call the pathos of the hero. Let's see if I... The epiphany shows a pathos of the hero of the story, which is a traditional way of referring to the path of the main character in the story, how they're introduced, they meet challenges, they overcome challenges, and they go through transformation, the traditional literary arc, the traditional way of storytelling. The first thing that we're going to do is learn about a specific type of writing technique that Frederick Douglass used, a persuasive writing technique. It means writing with a purpose, writing with an agenda. In this case, probably we should add to this idea of persuasive writing technique the idea of having a specific political agenda that is fulfilled throughout the path that the author follows in telling his story. He's telling his story for a reason. We're going to trace how slave narratives we're already familiar with them because we've studied Olaude Equiano, were developed into a vehicle to achieve abolitionism, to achieve the abolition of slavery, and how there was an increase in the production of slave narratives in the decades that led up to the American Civil War, 1820 from the 1820s to the early 1860s, where the American Civil War began. So as you can see, the 19th century is a century of maturity for American culture, but it's also a century of tragedy for American culture and for American reality. America's put to the test, and the principles on which the nation was created are tested and are put in question by the Americans themselves. The outcome of the American Civil War on paper seems very positive because it turned it left behind the negative effects of being a nation that tolerated slavery. In the eyes of the world, America turned into a superpower as all of this situation was happening at the same time as there was a massive expansion with the purchases of the Louisiana, the events that would lead to America acquiring Alaska and taking Texas away from Mexico, expanding to the Pacific Ocean with the Western states, and at the same time establishing a foothold on Pacific territories such as Hawaii or Caribbean territories that happened at the end of the century with the Spanish-American War that led to the loss by the Spanish, by the dwindling Spanish Empire of Cuba and Puerto Rico. All of those events are going to emerge from the America that emerges from this, from the American Civil War. So the American Civil War is a test to determine whether America is going to be a self-centered state that it has a strong divide north against south and is ripped apart by the problem of slavery, or emerges into a superpower as it did. The negative part of this was a social inequality that emerged from this abolition of slavery, because the end of slavery did not bring social justice. It brought a lot of social inequality and a lot of pain for millions of liberated Americans that received freedom overnight and for some dramatic days or weeks. They could have come to the conclusion that they never had to work again, that they were freed from the chains of working, until they realized that they were freed from the chains of working for somebody else. But they had to subsist and find a job in an America that had not considered them equal members of humanity for a very long time. The dehumanization process that we've seen so often, and I think that the examples that we're going to read in the first chapter of Frederick Douglass's autobiography are going to help you understand how cruel these elements of dehumanization are. Slaves were denied things that seemed so basic. They were denied their right to know when they had been born, who were their parents, to stay close to their mothers or mother and father if they were born from slaves. They were stripped of all those rights. They were stripped of any type of literacy. We're going to see how the same way as Olaudah Equiano embraced literacy, Frederick Douglass is going to embrace literacy as a way of achieving a higher status. And we're going to see how Frederick Douglass is so intellectually superior to many of his owners that it's going to be an appalling and an embarrassing situation for those slave owners to have a slave that seems more educated, is more elegant, and is more prepared for life than they are. And that's a typical situation that Frederick Douglass really strived to explain, that there was no inferiority in the in one race regarding another one, that all the races should have equal opportunities, and the laws of inequality that ravaged America over the 20th century, the Jim Crow laws, that basically treated Negroes or black people in a different way as they treated white people, were applied so harshly to Frederick Douglass and his importance about naming traditions and their importance for Afro-American identity. I will in a second. He is the example of how harmful these type of laws and these type of situations were. Regarding the question that Constance is making in the chat, African Americans, or well, African American is a modern terminology that we have for black people in America. It's a very recent, I would say almost 21st century type of reference. And the problem that language has, and especially in a case like this, is that the words have been misused so frequently. We're going to see with Mark Twain how There is a very controversial word that I'm going to have to use that is never uttered in an American environment. They refer to it as the N-word. Of course, you can come to the conclusion yourself about what word that is. The words used are so harmful because they've been used to create consistent and systematic pain that the African American community has had a very strong political agenda to eliminate any inclusion of that word in any form pronounced by anyone that wasn't from the community that is offended by that word. The ways that black people are referred to, well, we don't use black anymore. We don't use colored. I mean, the times of Martin Luther King, the most general way of refer to them were Negroes, dark-skinned. All of those words have been eliminated successively because they've been misused and mistreated. And at the end of the day, the only word that seems socially acceptable nowadays is African-American. In terms of what Constance is saying, one of the ways of stripping these people from their the slaves from their identity was to be named after the slave owner. Yeah, it would make sense to normalize. I think we're still a couple of generations away from normalization. We probably Americans need a couple of black or African American presidents to feel comfortable with going back to black and white and using a purely racial hue depending on the color of the skin, dark color, light colored, I don't know. There is a tendency now to use the word brown as anything that isn't white, and brown would refer to the black people, but also to the Mexicans or to the Latin Americans or to people from Asia that weren't Oriental. There's still a struggle there to make the language work, and that's something that, for example, in Spain we're not aware of that situation when we speak in Spanish because it's not such a hot topic because there hasn't been slavery in Spain for over 200 years, and that's it's an important factor to not have that problem. And it's not transferred to language. In terms of going back to the naming issue, normally slaves were deprived the opportunity to name their children. They were basically named by the slave owner of the slave that had it. A very famous example was Cassius Clay, the boxer that was the sixth Cassius Clay in his family, and was named after a famous Kentucky slave owner. Upon learning that information and because of how mistreated Cassius Clay felt during the 60s, he embraced a Muslim religion and he transformed his name a religious community called the Black Muslims that was very famous in the 60s and was involved with Malcolm X. He changed his name to Muhammad Ali. So that just goes to show how this has been a problem, not only in the times of Frederick Douglass, but even 100 years later in the times of Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, Martin Luther King, or Malcolm X. Frederick Douglass is a perfect example of the fight of the African American, of the black people, to claim their place in American culture and in American society, of erasing all those barriers, like the one that Constance mentioned. In the case of Malcolm X, I think it's his war name. I am not extremely familiar with Malcolm X's biography, but I mean, I can find out. I can just tell you that he suffered a terrible fate similar to the one Martin Luther King suffered. There's a very good HBO documentary about the life of Muhammad Ali that I really recommend you to gain more insight in terms of racialism in the 60s in the United States. Is very good. If you enjoy sports or if you enjoy boxing, you'll enjoy it double or triple. But from a cultural social point of view, great cultural content to consume these days of confinement. Going back to I'll mention that in a moment. Going back to what is the topic of this class? We're going to talk about the influence that was exerted by Frederick Douglass's three different autobiographies: one published in 1845, another revised edition in 1855, and a sort of authoritative extended version in 1881. It was all about rehashing his greatest hits and just extending them. In 1881, how these versions of his autobiography influenced his world and his time. As you can see, two of his autobiographies are pre-Civil War. One is post-Civil War. The first autobiography, the one that is the purpose or the topic of this unit, it ends right when Frederick Douglass achieves freedom and turns into a relevant anti-slavery figure and anti-abolitionist figure. So it's very interesting to notice, to understand the time that precedes the American Civil War. If we were to read the 1881 version, we would also come to the to an understanding of what the experience of the American Civil War was for slaves. If we go back to his work, we're going to see how his work was autobiographical but had extremely strong political implications, and how his autobiography served as a contribution, not only the autobiography, but his performances, his political speeches, his political persona, had a very strong effect in bringing the Civil War closer. His support for Abraham Lincoln, and how he helped in the recruiting process for the American Civil War. In the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave that he published in 1845, we can see a very strong command of rhetorical figure, and how he managed to challenge slavery with a counter discourse that is extremely powerful and extremely appealing and very well written. Before I continue here, and I'm going to go back to this at the end after we read the text, in this class I'm going to do something different to what I normally do. If you remember correctly, I normally skip most of the information in the textbook and go directly to reading the text. But I think that this unit in particular is very is strongly structured in the same way as if you were to read the work itself. I'm going to lead you through some important passages that I think are interesting to read before we listen to. In this occasion, we're going to listen to the recordings of his book read by a nicer voice than mine. And I want to please ask you to move to page 308 of the textbook, and we're going to read from the first full paragraph of that book. That page. This book, for this unit, we're going to read from four different chapters. We're going to read from the first chapter of the book, from the sixth chapter of the book. We're going to read two different passages from the 10th from the 10th chapter of the book. And we're going to read from the final part of the book in which is chapter 11. Okay, so his narrative has 11 chapters. I'm going to read what's relevant for that passage. Then we're going to read the text. So we're going to read what's left of page 308 and half of page 309. And then I'm going to ask you to move to page 313. So we read chapter 1. Then we'll go back. We'll read about chapter 6, the same about chapter 10 and chapter 11, finally. Okay? I don't know if there's... Yeah, chapter 10. Okay, so from chapter 1, on page 208, the Professor Gibert says the following. Unlike Olada Equiano in the previous century, Frederick Douglass had not been captured in America, sorry, in Africa, but was born a slave on a Maryland plantation in 1818. Okay, so this is really important. This difference of origin is seminal to understand that this situation. These are not slaves that were brought from an African land and set to work in a place where they did not speak the language, they did not understand the religion. These were Americans. These were Americans being born into slavery and bringing the figure of slavery to new heights in terms of cruelty. Not even society that established slavery for centuries, such as, for example, the Romans, when they captured enemies, these were very frequently enslaved. Normally, their children were liberated because it was a nuisance to have several generations of slaves. It was just not a practical thing. But the institution of slavery was so deeply rooted in American society that it was well seen by certain parts of the nation to enslave not only these slaves brought from Africa, but all the generations born after them. So I think that element, it's not a subtle element. It's a very important element. He was born around 1818. We're going to see how being denied his birth date is one of the first elements of cruelty that we find. He inherited his slave condition from his black mother, Harriet Bailey, from whom he was separated as an infant, to be raised by his maternal grandmother on a distant farm. The identity of his white father remains uncertain, although it was widely suspected that it was his mother's master, Captain Aaron Anthony, who worked as general overseer for the extremely wealthy Colonel Edward Lloyd. From his father, Frederick only inherited the physical traits that made him a rather light-skinned mulatto, that is, someone defined as black by American custom and law. Being officially fatherless, the boy was called Bailey after his mother and kept the surname until his escape, when he changed it several times to elude slave hunters and finally adopted that of Douglass for its literary connections. This is what Constant was saying. If you look at footnote 2, it says the name of Douglass was suggested to him in 1838 by his black abolitionist friend, Mr. Johnson, who had just finished reading Sir Walter Scott. Sir Walter Scott again, Sir Walter Scott's narrative, the poem, The Lady of the Lake. So as you can see, Sir Walter Scott and Ralph Waldo Emerson are everywhere, even in the least expected places, in which the strong, rebellious Lord James of Douglas is one of the main characters. So as you can see, it's a rehashing of that name, the same way as Nathaniel Hawthorne changed his name due to feeling ashamed of the Hawthorne lineage to Hawthorne. Frederick Bailey changed his name to Frederick Douglass. as a way of empowering himself and having a dominance over his destiny, which can be expressed in deciding your own name. At the age of 8, Frederick was sent to Baltimore by Thomas Auld, Captain Anthony's son-in-law, to live as a house servant with the family of his brother Hugh, whose wife Sophia kindly started teaching the boy to read. As Hugh Auld considered that learning would make the child unfit for slavery, Mrs. Auld stopped instructing him. Eventually, she became even more opposed than her husband to letting Frederick study and did everything in her power to prevent it. So as you can see, literacy is an awakening force for Frederick Douglass that understands that this thing that is being denied to him is very important, and he's going to embrace the importance of being literate. We're going to see that when we read this passage. In spite of her efforts, a young slave was so determined to learn that he continued his instruction through a series of ruses, such as noticing the letters marked on pieces of timber for the construction of ships, copying from his little master's spelling book when no one was at home, and exchanging bread for the aid of poor white schoolboys he met in the streets. Years later, when the author recalled this momentous episode in his autobiography, he pointed out that the acquisition of literacy would be for him, as for many other fugitives, the pathway from slavery to freedom. That's a quote I use at the beginning of the today's unit. As you can see, that's the epiphany. That's the first epiphany in his life. Indeed, the first book he owned and carefully studied was a copy of the Eloquence Manual, the Columbian Orator, a collection of classic poems, dialogues, and speeches, many of which vindicated human rights and denounced oppression. His painfully acquired knowledge also allowed him to read the Baltimore American, where he found articles on abolition that increased his thirst for freedom. Okay, let's listen to that part. I want to ask you to please move to page 313. Okay, so this is from the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave, written by himself. You guys, a teacher. What does that mean? Can you hear me? You can't hear me? Carlos? Can you hear me? You can't hear me. Maybe if you... I can hear, yeah, I mean, I can see all of you interacting there, but I mean, I'm not very sure if it's maybe it's Carlos's computer. If you have any problems, last week was terrible, for example, with the recordings. Let me write something down. Last week it happened a lot. My recommendation is exit and re-enter. Yeah, exactly that, what he was doing right now. Okay, so I'm going to... Oops, I've got this upside down. Headphones are on the top. I'm going to play it on a tablet, and therefore you should be able to hear it through the microphone, okay? So, yeah, here it goes.
I was born in Tuckahoe, near Hillsboro, and about 12 miles from Easton in Talbot County, Maryland. I have no accurate knowledge of my age, never having seen any authentic record containing it. By far, the larger part of the slaves know as little of their ages as horses know of theirs, and it is the wish of most masters within my knowledge to keep their slaves thus ignorant. I do not remember to have ever met a slave who could tell of his birthday. They seldom come nearer to it than planting time, harvest time, cherry time, spring time, or fall time. A want of information concerning my own was a source of unhappiness to me even during childhood. The white children could tell their ages. I could not tell why I ought to be deprived of the same privilege. I was not allowed to make any inquiries of my master concerning it. He deemed all such inquiries on the part of a slave improper and impertinent, and evidence of a restless spirit. The nearest estimate I can give makes me now between 27 and 28 years of age. I come to this from hearing my master say, sometime during 1835, I was about 17 years old. My mother was named Harriet Bailey. She was the daughter of Isaac and Betsy Bailey, both colored and quite dark. My mother was of a darker complexion than either my grandmother or grandfather. My father was a white man. He was admitted to be such by all I ever heard speak of my parentage. The opinion was also whispered that my master was my father, but of the correctness of this opinion I know nothing. The means of knowing was withheld from me. My mother and I were separated when I was but an infant, before I knew her as my mother. It is a common custom, in the part of Maryland from which I ran away, to part children from their mothers at a very early age. Frequently, before the child has reached its 12th month, the mother is taken from it and hired out on some farm a considerable distance off, and the child is placed under the care of an old woman, too old for field labor. For what this separation is done, I do not know, unless it be to hinder the development of the child's affection towards its mother, and to blunt and destroy the natural affection of the mother for the child. This is the inevitable result.
Okay, so that first part brings us to the cruelty of the details of slavery and how slave babies were taken away from their mother to sever the emotional connection, and how risking that disobeying that separation could cost these slave mothers severe punishment and sometimes even death. If you're familiar with the American author that sadly passed away last year, Toni Morrison, one of her most important works is called Beloved, and there you have you have an excellent example of this type of reality and how difficult it was for slaves even in free states, how terrible the situation was, and how this relationship of slaves with their children, how difficult the relationship of slaves with their children actually was. Yes, it's a very, very good novel and very recommendable. It brings a lot of insight. From regarding chapter 6, I'm going to go back to page 309. I'm going to read one paragraph more to illustrate chapter 6 before we listen to it. After working for 7 years as an urban slave in Baltimore, Douglas was sent back to the plantation, which had become the property of Thomas Auld. Accustomed to the relatively privileged life of the city, the teenager found that the exhausting work and the strict conditions enforced on the plantation were intolerable for his independent spirit. Since he became increasingly rebellious, he was hired out as a farm worker under the supervision of Edward Covey, an overseer of fierce and savage disposition, well known for his stern training of young slaves, an activity generally called slave breaking. For a while, Covey succeeded in breaking the 16-year-old slave in body, soul, and spirit, with repeated humiliations and severe whippings. Finally, after a fight in which the youngster resisted one of Covey's beatings, an end was put to this brutality. Okay, so we're going to go back to page 314 and read from that chapter. This is from chapter 6. This is around the second minute of the chapter. I'm going to play I'm going to play, well, I don't know. No, I'm going to just play that part. This is the part before chapter. This is the part before encountering Covey, when Frederick Douglass is taught to read. So I'm going to play this part, and then I'm going to play the section from chapter 10. Okay, I'm going to look for the part.
Of my progress,
the part where he encounters he is introduced to Mr. Auld's wife, to Mrs. Auld, and she instructs him, or she begins to instruct him, until Mr. Auld makes her aware of the, let's air quote this, evils of teaching a slave literacy, how that could spoil the slave. Okay, it says it can spoil the best nigger in the world. Okay, there I go. I said the terrible, unnameable word, but well, it's for the sake of illustrating. Please pay attention. It's right after the end of this sentence.
One of harsh and horrid discord, and that angelic face gave place to that of a demon. Very soon after I went to live with Mr. and Mrs. Auld, she very kindly commenced to teach me the ABC. After I had learned this, she assisted me in learning to spell words of three or four letters. Just at this point in my progress, Mr. Auld found out what was going on, and at once forbade Mrs. Auld to instruct me further, telling her, among other things, that it was unlawful, as well as unsafe, to teach a slave to read. To use his own words, further, he said, "If you give a nigger an inch, he will take an ell. A nigger should know nothing but to obey his master, to do as he is told to do. Learning would spoil the best nigger in the world. Now," said he, "if you teach that nigger," speaking of myself, "how to read, there would be no keeping him. It would forever unfit him to be a slave. He would at once become unmanageable and of no value to his master. As to himself, it could do him no good but a great deal of harm. It would make him discontented and unhappy." These words sank deep into my heart, stirred up sentiments within that lay slumbering, and called into existence an entirely new train of thought. It was a new and special revelation, explaining dark and mysterious things, with which my youthful understanding had struggled, but struggled in vain. I now understood what had been to me a most perplexing difficulty, to wit, the white man's power to enslave the black man. It was a grand achievement, and I prized it highly. From that moment, I understood the pathway from slavery to freedom. It was just what I...
Okay, from that moment I understood the pathway from slavery to freedom. That's a moment of epiphany. Okay, if you want to mark it in your book, that's a clear form of epiphany. When he's denied literacy, he understands the power of literacy, and he uses literacy as his vital driving force. In chapter 10, it's what we described before. I should have played the part after. Sorry, I should have played this part before reading from chapter 10. We're going to listen to I think it's two passages of chapter 10. Yes, they're separate. On the first page, on page 315, we're going to listen to something that is at the more or less at the beginning of this very long chapter, and afterwards we're going to listen to another section that is halfway through the chapter. They're both strongly connected. Let me select that for you.
As soon as I found what he...
The first part is over here. Okay. In around 12 seconds, the section that we're referring to starts. Okay. Wait, I'm going to flip this around. There you go. Can you hear everything well? Can you hear the narrator read the story? I think it's nice to change the voices once in a while, and that way you're exposed to other accents. It's always good practice.
I was sometimes prompted to take my life, and that of Covey, but was prevented by a combination of hope and fear. My sufferings on this plantation seem now like a dream rather than a stern reality.
Now the part starts.
Our house stood within a few rods of the Chesapeake Bay, whose broad bosom was ever white with sails from every quarter of the habitable globe. Those beautiful vessels, robed in purest white, so delightful to the eye of freemen, were to me so many shrouded ghosts, to terrify and torment me with thoughts of my wretched condition. I have often, in the deep stillness of a summer's Sabbath, stood all alone upon the lofty banks of that noble bay, and traced, with saddened heart and tearful eye, the countless number of sails moving off to the mighty ocean. The sight of these always affected me powerfully. My thoughts would compel utterance, and there, with no audience but the Almighty, I would pour out my soul's complaint, in my rude way, with an apostrophe to the moving multitude of ships. You are loosed from your moorings, and are free. I am fast in my chains, and am a slave. You move merrily before the gentle gale, and I sadly before the bloody whip. You are freedom's swift-winged angels that fly around the world. I am confined in bands of iron. Oh, that I were free! Oh, that I were on one of your gallant decks and under your protecting wing! Alas, betwixt you and me the turbid waters roll. Go on, go on. Oh, that I could also go. Could I but swim? If I could fly. Oh, why was I born a man of whom to make a brute? The glad ship is gone. She hides in the dim distance. I am left in the hottest hell of unending slavery. Oh, God, save me. God, deliver me. Let me be free. Is there any God? Why am I a slave? I will run away. I will not stand it. Get caught or get clear, I'll try it. I had as well die with ague as the fever. I have only one life to lose. I had as well be killed running as die standing. Only think of it. 100 miles straight north, and I am free. Try it? Yes. God helping me, I will. It cannot be that I shall live and die a slave. I will take to the water. This very bay shall yet bear me into freedom. The steamboat steered in a northeast course from North Point. I will do the same. And when I get to the head of the bay, I will turn my canoe adrift and walk straight through Delaware into Pennsylvania. When I get there, I shall not be required to have a pass. I can travel without being disturbed. Let but the first opportunity offer, and come what will, I am off. Meanwhile, I will try to bear up under the yoke. I am not the only slave in the world. Why should I fret? I can bear as much as any of them. Besides, I am but a boy, and all boys are bound to someone. It may be that my misery and slavery will only increase my happiness when I get free. There is a better day coming.
Okay, as you can see, this passage is extremely modernist. It's an interior dialogue that is very powerful. There's a sort of internal reflection, but afterwards it goes on to be like an internal conversation with himself, how he tries to convince himself that he's very, very close to freedom and that he can achieve it. I like this interior dialogue that takes place in this part, and I think that it indicates the level of sophistication that Frederick Douglass as a writer acquires. To compare the beginning with Moby Dick is also a very important comparison, because it brings us it leaves a very clear example of the amount of literary quality that the work itself has. We're only halfway through this part, but this section of the passage and the next section is separated by 10 minutes in the audio file. So it's very separated in the in the narrative. Let me take that to the close, as close as I can. Moment, almost there. Okay. The scroll isn't letting me get close enough. Let me see if I can do that. Okay, there you go. Long before daylight.
Daylight, I was called to go and rub, curry, and feed the horses. I obeyed and was glad to obey. But whilst thus engaged, whilst in the act of throwing down some blades from the loft, Mr. Covey entered the stable with a long rope, and just as I was half out of the loft, he caught hold of my legs and was about tying me. As soon as I found...
As you can see, there's a process where Mr. Covey is trying to break Frederick as a slave. He's trying to persist in torturing him. As a way of subduing him, and this is where where Frederick is going to have another moment that is very important in terms of standing the ground and making Covey know that he's not going to be punished any longer, and that he's going to fight back, and this is it's a pivotal moment for him as a slave, because he stops being physically enslaved in the same terms as he was before.
What he was up to, I gave a sudden spring, and as I did so, he holding to my legs, I was brought sprawling on the stable floor. Mr. Covey seemed now to think he had me, and could do what he pleased, but at this moment, from whence came the spirit, I don't know, I resolved to fight. And suiting my action to the resolution, I seized Covey hard by the throat, and as I did so, I rose. He held on to me, and I to him. My resistance was so entirely unexpected that Covey seemed taken all aback. He trembled like a leaf. This gave me assurance, and I held him uneasy, causing the blood to run where I touched him with the ends of my fingers. Mr. Covey soon called out to Hughes for help. Hughes came, and, while Covey held me, attempted to tie my right hand. While he was in the act of doing so, I watched my chance, and gave him a heavy kick close under the ribs. This kick fairly sickened Hughes, so that he left me in the hands of Mr. Covey. The kick had the effect of not only weakening Hughes, but Covey also. When he saw Hughes bending over with pain, his courage quailed. He asked me if I meant to persist in my resistance. I told him I did, come what might, that he had used me like a brute for 6 months, and that I was determined to be used so no longer. With that, he strove to drag me to a stick that was lying just out of the stable door. He meant to knock me down, but just as he was leaning over to get the stick, I seized him with both hands by his collar and brought him by a sudden snatch to the ground. By this time, Bill came. Covey called upon him for assistance. Bill wanted to know what he could do. Covey said, "Take hold of him, take hold of him." Bill said his master hired him out to work and not to help whip me. So he left Covey and myself to fight our own battle out. We were at it for nearly 2 hours. Covey at length let me go, puffing and blowing at a great rate, saying that if I had not resisted, he would not have whipped me half so much. The truth was that he had not whipped me at all. I considered him as getting entirely the worst end of the bargain, for he had drawn no blood from me, but I had from him. The whole 6 months afterwards that I spent with Mr. Covey, he never laid the weight of his finger upon me in anger. He would occasionally say he didn't want to get hold of me again. No, thought I, you need not, for you will come off worse than you did before. This battle with Mr. Covey was a turning point in my career as a slave.
Again, it's another moment of epiphany for Frederick. He realizes that he no longer has to be physically subdued by Covey, and he understands that he can fight for his for respect first, and for his freedom in the second place. So this sparks even more the fire of wanting to be a freed man. I think it's an interesting turning point.
It rekindled the few expiring embers of freedom and revived within me a sense of my own manhood. It recalled the...
I've seen that a couple of students have come into the classroom where we're on page 317 of the textbook. Okay, we're going through the third of the four passages that we cover in this unit.
Parted self-confidence and inspired me again with the determination to be free. The gratification afforded by the triumph was a full compensation for whatever else might follow, even death itself. He only can understand the deep satisfaction of which I experienced, who has himself repelled by force the bloody arm of slavery. I felt as I never felt before. It was a glorious resurrection from the tomb of slavery to the heaven of freedom. My long-crushed spirit rose, cowardice departed, bold defiance took its place, and I now resolved that, however long I might remain a slave in form, the day had passed forever when I could be a slave in fact. I did not hesitate to let it be known of me that the white man who expected to succeed in whipping must also succeed in killing me. From this time, I was never...
Okay, so I think that within this topic that we were talking about, a key word that I've brought forward today as epiphany, I think that with a similar religious connotation, we can come to the conclusion that Frederick Douglass is a very, very skillful writer, and he's able to convey ideas in a very powerful way using his life as a platform. In this